It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The legislature's Joint Audit Committee recently voted in favor of two financial probes that involved the Department of Public Instruction and the Department of Natural Resources. The audit of the state education department comes in the wake of Milwaukee Public Schools failing to submit required financial data to the state on time. The district is already the subject of audits by the state. The audit in the DNR is set to examine how funds are being spent from Wisconsin's Fish and Wildlife account. To discuss these mandated audits, we have Republican State Senator Eric Wimberger of Green Bay, co-chair of the Joint Legislative Audit Committee. State Senator Wimberger, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Well, it's good to be back. Thanks.
What do you want the Department of Public Instruction audit to do? What are you thinking that you might find?
We're focusing more on the DPI side of things and see where that trail leads. But generally, it's about how DPI is monitoring these state-required audits on school districts. So every September 15th, every school district is supposed to be doing an internal audit. They can hire a firm, or in the case of Milwaukee Public Schools, they have a finance team, and I think they still hire people out too. But it turns out that many schools are not doing their audits. And then what happens is there's a distribution of funds through a formula, school formula. And also there's referenda that get run in that April usually. And people don't have any information about what's going on in those schools. And DPI isn't pointing that out before these referenda get run.
How connected is this audit of DPI, Department of Public Instruction, to Milwaukee Public Schools' recent failure to submit required financial documents to DPI on time?
Well, I think it's not the same focus as what the governor had done through the executive branch at his discretion there, I suppose. This is more of a system analysis rather than what might be the best way to operate MPS in particular. It's not really driven towards that. That's kind of a Milwaukee-centric issue to determine. So I guess it would be more of a system-wide examination rather than an MPS focus. However, to understand how DPI failed in this circumstance, I'm sure that the Audit Bureau will be kind of looking into what happened at MPS.
One more thing about Milwaukee Public Schools. It just hired a new chief financial officer in Aicha Sawa. And when Sawa was Milwaukee City Controller, she launched this open checkbook so anyone could see how the city was spending its money. What are your thoughts on this and thoughts on a new chief financial officer?
Really have no idea about what their internals are. The thing that was really important to understand about that DPI hearing last week was that when it comes to non-compliance with audit standards, there is a rule, and it's Rule 14. And what it says is that any audit that the department determines is in non-compliance with the section shall be referred to the school district for corrective action. So what was going on there is that there's an interpretation by DPI about what it means to be non-compliant and then also what it means to refer it to the school district for corrective action. The decision that DPI made, at least what we can initially tell, is that when there is no audit period at all, then an audit can't be non-compliant, because they are claiming that only an audit can be non-compliant is if it started. Mm-hmm. But the absence of an audit, it can't be non-compliant. And I thought that was fascinating. And then when they said, when the rule says refer it to the school district for corrective action, they're actually referring it to the superintendent and to the finance team, the very people who are, you know, not doing the audit. And therefore, nothing ever becomes public about what these audits or the absence of an audit. And the public ought to have knowledge of these things.
In that refer back, I'm thinking about local control, right? The decentralized nature of schools. Do you want DPI to have more control of fiscal decisions and the financial matters in individual districts?
Oh, not in particular. That's not really the aim. It's just DPI is supposed to be kind of a check on whether there's some funny business locally, so that localities don't have, you know, major problems. They're getting money from the state, and then it's being, you know, misused or not used right. And so if it's not being monitored the way DPI is supposed to be doing it, you end up with these problems like at MPS.
On Tuesday, WPR asked Governor Evers about the Joint Legislative Audit Committee's plan for a review of how DPI is analyzing district financial data. And let's listen to how Evers responded.
I'm not sure what the department has done wrong. I think it's ridiculous, frankly. Right. They're doing their good work. The people here are doing the best job they can, and we're going to continue to support them. Obviously, we're doing some audits with Milwaukee Public Schools. So I don't think we need to be audit crazy at this point in time. I think what we're asking the school district to do is reasonable audits, and I'm looking forward to those results.
Do you think... are there redundancies in doing multiple audits? Is there a situation of layering audit on top of another?
The governor is just simply wrong or obfuscating what's going on there on the executive side of things. MPS was delinquent in their audit way back in April of 2022. And what DPI apparently did was kind of use old numbers to estimate what their distribution or their share of the state funds should be, and said, well, we'll give you some extra time to get in your old audits and to make a new audit. And they were meeting with them monthly and then basically weekly up at the end there. And they still didn't present an audit through 2023. And then all of a sudden 2024 rolls around and DPI, let the hammer down by not only clawing back the $40 million that was the estimated increase they were supposed to be, but then dinged them an additional $40 million on this annually thing. So they're out $80 million essentially just for failing to complete their audit. And so the failing of DPI, meanwhile, Milwaukee had run obviously that $200 million referendum. So how people would vote, how people would respond to the demands on public officials, the monitoring of where money's going and why. Obviously, this is going to eat into the MPS budget. So these things have significant ramifications with the lack of monitoring and information out to the public.
We're talking with Republican State Senator Eric Wimberger of Green Bay, co-chair of the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, about recent audits ordered for two state agencies. Switching gears here to the DNR, looking at the DNR and using its funds and its fish and wildlife account. Can you explain what you're looking into here?
This one, I think the jury's out. There's not like so much suspicion yet, I suppose. Back in the 90s, I guess there was an issue with more administration being eating into the Fish and Wildlife Fund rather than being used for habitat rehabilitation or replenishing fish stocks and that kind of stuff. So there were some changes made in the early 2000s regarding that fund. But in the recent years, there's been not enough money coming in through the revenue of licenses so to cover the costs associated with all the fund there. So we actually kind of backfilled it by $25 million last budget. And then there were some remaining questions. What is going on here with this fund? How do we want to deal with this? And it very well could be that everything is on the up and up. And, you know, it's just a deficiency in the licensing revenue, and we backfill it because we want to keep licenses low.
Right. I mean, if you find through the audit, there are just fewer hunters and fishers in Wisconsin, leading to shrinking revenues through these licenses and fees. How do you suggest the DNR adjust to that?
Maybe they don't. I just think it's a big unknown. All we know right now is that there's a deficiency or a you know, it's lacking in the revenues. So I just don't want to pass judgment yet in any way, unlike the DPI audit, where I think that there's some wrongness going on and we're going to follow a particular path. I think this is just something that needs to be explored because there's a lack of information. And then we'll kind of figure out from that point.
Give us a timeline here on these audits and explain again who is doing them.
Sure. It's the Legislative Audit Bureau. It's nonpartisan because obviously there's certain people on a committee that are elected in a partisan election, and Republicans hold those seats right now. But we direct the Audit Bureau on what we want investigated, and then the Audit Bureau just kind of disappears until they're done with their audit. We don't meet with them or talk with them or direct them to do anything or respond in any way. They just kind of go where the problem leads them, basically, and they just try to ask a bunch of questions. And then all of a sudden, one day, we get a notification that their report's done, and then we meet and have a hearing. So their estimated time, I guess we don't know. I would say the Fish and Wildlife Fund is going to probably take longer, only because we're investigating the federal fund revenue as well as the state fund revenue. We're trying to get the DPI one a little bit faster because it's primarily directed at state funds and we're in a budget year. So I guess those answers are probably more prescient.
State Senator Wimberger, thank you so much for joining us.
You bet. Thanks for having me again.
Eric Wimberger is a state senator representing the 30th District in Green Bay and co-chair of the Joint Legislative Audit Committee. He was with us to talk about the committee's new mandated audits involving the State Education Department and the DNR. Coming up on Wisconsin Today, find out why the state is changing the way standardized tests are measured in schools and how schools can succeed in the middle of political arguments.
Teachers and students can accomplish a lot together. That it's almost like when you close the door, you can close off a lot of these outside distractions and disputes.
That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin is getting older, and as the state ages, more people need long-term care. Despite that growing demand, many providers can't cover their bills. The state health department reported that 148 assisted living facilities closed voluntarily in 2023 alone. Closures continued into this year, with many providers citing issues with increasing staffing costs and lagging state reimbursements. Addy Costello reports on the closures and the temporary solution aimed at stopping them.
From the outside, Rosalanda's assisted living home looks like any other house in the Madison neighborhood. And in many ways, Good Hand Care is like any other home. Residents read and watch TV together. Landa's twins visit the house and play in the yard. And in the kitchen, she and her mom prepare home-cooked meals. For today's lunch, Landa mixes tuna salad while her mom grills quesadillas for the picky eaters in the house. By 11, the table is set.
Lunch is ready, Pam. Lunch is ready, Babette.
Landa sits with residents at the small kitchen table. They play word games as they eat. Everyone tries to think of words that start with the letter R.
Instead of a mouse, it's a...
Yeah, that's what everyone was thinking. And then everyone wanted to say it, everybody's eating.
Up until a couple of months ago, Landa lived in the home alongside residents. With only four people in the house, Landa says...
You get to know them, like, thoroughly.
you get to know them in their ups and downs, their good and their bad. They become kind of like a family.
But they're also customers. Landa says most pay for their care through Medicaid, but the government payments don't always match the cost of care. Early on, Landa remembers thinking,
I'm not going to be able to keep the house open.
Many providers haven't. WPR obtained records from 86 providers who closed in the last 5 years, displacing over 750 residents. Almost two-thirds listed low state reimbursements or staffing shortages in their reasons for closing. Wisconsin Medicaid Director Bill Hanna says the state's long-term care providers need help fast.
It's at a crisis point right now.
Last month, Governor Tony Evers directed the state health department to use pandemic relief dollars to increase reimbursements and set a minimum monthly payment for providers. That won't start until October, but Hanna says it's already helping.
I got phone calls the day of the announcement from providers who called and said, we were about to tell our board we needed to start closing procedures, but because of the minimum fee, we're able to stay open.
But that relief is only guaranteed through June of next year. Then it's up to the legislature to decide if the state will pay to continue the increase. Lawmakers already blocked the plan in April. While advocates and providers hope the increase will stick, they say it's not enough.
I don't think they understand it. They don't see it. They don't live it. We do.
That's Barbara Hendricks. She owns Marvin's Manor, an assisted living facility in Dodge County. To retain staff, Hendricks says she raised employee wages from around $14 to $17 an hour. But as staff wages got higher, Hendricks' Medicaid rate stayed the same. After covering costs with her own savings, Hendricks decided to close her other facility in Waupun last month, forcing 12 seniors to move.
Going to see the residents now, you can see they're sad. They're not home. They're just not home.
Hendricks says her Dodge County facility will just make it, but only because around half of the facility's residents pay privately. She says Medicaid pays her a little more than half of what she normally charges. While she's not expecting to get rich, she hopes to see a rate increase so she can afford to do more for all the seniors in her care.
Their life doesn't end coming to an assisted living. It shouldn't. They should still have fun and enjoy life. And we make that happen.
Whether it's paying for a concert from a local musician or making root beer floats, she still finds ways to splurge for her residents. Addie Costello, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And this piece was produced in partnership with the nonprofit Wisconsin Watch. It's back to school time, and that means it's back to standardized tests. This year, the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction is changing the way it categorizes students' scores on the state's standardized exams. Under the previous system, test scores fell into one of four categories, ranging from advanced on the high end to proficient, basic, and below basic on the low end. Starting this fall, DPI is lowering the thresholds to reach those categories, so a larger portion of students will score in the higher categories. Plus, they're changing what they're calling each category. State leaders say the changes will help students, while critics say it's just changing the goalposts without helping academic achievement in Wisconsin. Alan Borsick is a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette Law School. He analyzed the test score policy changes in recent articles for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he talked with my co-host, Rob Ferret. Here's a listen.
Before we dig into these changes in the tests, I want to establish which tests we're talking about. I'm a parent. I got a couple kids now who've gone through the Wisconsin schools, and there were a lot of standardized tests over the years. Which ones are we looking at here when it comes to these changes and what the standards mean?
It's basically the full array of tests that are required by the state of Wisconsin. You're right that a lot of school districts do other tests. Tests that are done maybe three times a year or such, but these are the annual tests done in the spring for third grade through eighth graders. They're called the forward test for ninth through, I think, normally 11th graders. It's a variation on the ACT college admission test, but it's the state of Wisconsin required test.
Now take us through the timeline of how these test score thresholds have changed back, 2012 and now here in 2024?
2012 was a very important date. At that time, both nationally and in Wisconsin, you had a lot of pressure, a lot of advocacy to strengthen the rigor of systems, that kids weren't being prepared for college enough, that too little was expected of kids. Wisconsin was regarded at that time, based on analysis from some national advocacy groups, as having some of the softest standards, some of the easiest standards for defining a student as proficient or better, that the bar was quite low. So there was advocacy to toughen up tests. There was advocacy to go, that was the time of the Common Core, to have more rigorous and more consistent expectations and curriculums for students. Frankly, almost all of this didn't pay off as far as improved achievement nationwide. So the superintendent at that time, Evers, raised the bars very substantially, largely to match those that were being used by the National Assessment of Educational Progress, which is a program that's required by federal law to be used in all 50 states about every 2 years for reading and math for fourth and eighth graders, and in a certain sequence for some other subjects, and occasionally for 12th graders. But it's the closest thing we have to a national testing system. NAEP is a very tough grader. Everybody agrees with that. To be called proficient by NAEP is really a pretty high standard. Wisconsin went to that standard, and as expected, the percentage of students who were labeled as proficient or advanced went down sharply at that time, even though that didn't reflect any actual change in student performance. It was just a change in what you had to do to get labeled in one category or another. The idea was that this would increase rigor, it would raise expectations, more students would succeed in becoming college ready as defined by OSA, ACT, and others. Frankly, that part didn't work. Ultimately, student performance didn't change very much, except the percentages changed. Things didn't really go up. A lot of educators hated this system because it was aimed so high. And now what we have is reversing that, basically admitting this was a failure, lowering the bars. It's not quite clear we're lowering them back to where they were before 2012. Probably not quite that, but nonetheless lowering the bars. The percentage of students who will be in the higher categories is going to go up when they release data from the test for last spring, which will be maybe late September or early October. So it's going to look better for schools without actually changing student performance perhaps at all. In addition, they changed the labels,
right,
which is a whole other subject.
And I want to get into that. Actually, that's where I wanted to go next. They've changed these thresholds, right, for these four different categories.
Yes.
They're also changing the names, especially and most significantly, I think, at the lower end of performance. What changes are we seeing?
Well, for many years, Wisconsin has had four categories: advanced, proficient, basic, and below basic. In my very informal and unscientific definition, below basic meant you really weren't on the playing field as far as succeeding in school. Basic meant you were on the playing field, but you weren't where anyone wanted, that wasn't the goal. The goal was to be proficient. The percentage of students who were below basic was quite high statewide, and especially in low-income communities like the city of Milwaukee. So it was a pretty unattractive picture. Now you're going to have four different categories. Advanced remains advanced. Proficient is now called meeting, M-E-E-T-I-N-G, like going to a meeting, but meeting the standards. What was basic is now called approaching. And below basic is now called developing.
Part of the thought there, Alan, is these are things that are used to measure schools and school districts, but the kids and their families see this result as individuals. And how's it making them feel to see below basic? Does that lead kids to give up? I mean, is that part of the thinking here that, hey, kids might see this result and there's a stigma and they give up?
That is definitely part of the thinking on the part of the Department of Public Instruction and on the part of the state superintendent currently, Joe Underly, that these are kind of harsh terms, and it can really hurt a kid's self-esteem and their interest in school. I mean, how'd you like to be called below basic? And so on an individual student level, this has been especially unpopular with a lot of educators for many years. As far as what kind of label to use, I mean, if you're calling kids developing, a lot of kids are developing by whatever that means, but there are a lot of kids, especially in the harder hit, the higher needs areas, like the parts of the city of Milwaukee, parts of Madison, parts of Appleton, Green Bay, Beloit, you know, Milwaukee's not the only place. There are a lot of kids who are not developing, if that means making progress. There are a lot of kids who are really detached, who are really not engaged, who are really not progressing. So one of my questions is, calling them developing, where does that leave any effort to meet their needs?
Talking to Alan Borsuk, senior fellow at Marquette Law School, longtime education columnist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, about changes in the thresholds, the standards in statewide school testing. Alan, you've pointed out over the years that sometimes politics gets into our education policy. A lot of disagreements, but I think one thing people agreed on a lot, two decades ago, is we need data. We need measurables. We need to understand how schools and students are doing in order to fix the problems. And I think people have accused it of spreading almost into data fetishism, like testing and collecting data for its own sake. Do we get obsessed with how we collect data at the expense of maybe what you were just saying, actually helping kids?
Well, that's a really good question. If you go back to the passage in 2001 and early 2002 of the federal law, the most sweeping federal education law ever, which was called No Child Left Behind, and it mandated all sorts of steps to try to deal with schools that were not meeting standards, annual yearly progress, and all sorts of things. Overall, No Child Left Behind was not a successful program because things didn't change. But it did. That was the first time the federal government required every state to take standardized tests, to report the data, disaggregate the data by not only race and income, but by some other categories, including by special education status. It was the first time the spotlight was put on how our kids with special needs doing. So No Child Left Behind unleashed this huge wave of data. It didn't accomplish much else, frankly, but it did create this mountain of data. Data is a way to understand what's going on, but data isn't a solution. As the cliche always goes, you don't fatten your farm animals by weighing them. You fatten them by feeding them. And we were doing a lot of weighing and not too much feeding, both in Wisconsin and nationwide. In 2015 and 16, the No Child Left Behind law was basically erased. The federal government retreated in major ways from playing a role in state and local education practices and setting goals. But the one thing that stayed in the new education law, which is known as the Every Student Succeeds Act, it's hard for me to say that name with a straight face since it didn't really do anything to help students succeed. But one of the things that stayed in that law was a national testing requirement.
Do you see efforts going on here in the state, maybe a local district or something, to focus on that feeding side, you know, to actually help students learn? Do you see positive shoots out there somewhere, Alan?
There isn't much going on to actually improve student outcomes. I mean, I admit I see things through a lens of living in the city of Milwaukee and keeping an eye on Milwaukee public schools, which is just such a troubled system. And, you know, at the state level, in the budget that was approved in 2023, there was $50 million to be spent over 2 years on improving reading programs and emphasizing the more science of reading, as it's called, which is best known for phonics and such. The governor, the legislature approved and the governor signed this bill, now known as Act 20, including $50 million that was supposed to be used for helping local schools buy curriculum and have reading coaches and training teachers to better. Over $49 million of that remains locked up in the legislature because of a dispute between the governor and the Republican-controlled Joint Finance Committee. That's money that was supposed to be spent starting this year, and it's not happening. You say, why? Not because it's not an educational need, not because it's not in the law, because of the politics that are freezing that up.
Alan, we've got teachers, you know, clocking in now for the new school year on the ground, trying to do their jobs in the midst of all this. Your thoughts on our educators out there, what they're contending with, the challenges they're facing, and I don't know, any encouragement for them or wherever you want to take it?
I could offer actually quite a bit of encouragement when it comes to individual teachers and life in their classrooms. Once the door closes on the classroom, lots can go on between a teacher and students. There are huge problems. There's attendance problems. There's engagement problems. There's mental health and other health-related problems for kids. But teachers and students can accomplish a lot together. That it's almost like when you close the door, you can close off a lot of these outside distractions and disputes and barriers. And so I hope teachers, especially those who have younger students, kindergarten, first, second, third grades, where the groundwork is laid for educational success so much, I hope they have a great year. I hope they accomplish a lot. But it's going to be at that level the most of teachers and kids in an actual classroom.
Alan, thanks again for joining us today.
I hope this was helpful.
That's Alan Borsick at Marquette Law School. Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, meet the state's incredible mushrooms and the people who go hunting for them.
You can buy all the books in the world, but until you get out in the field and get your hands on these things, you're not really seeing what they really are.
That's coming up here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. The Green Bay Packers regular season kicks off tonight. And here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a Janesville business owner whose products help people hear their football games better.
Waves are everywhere. They make up light, color, and heat. In a very literal sense, waves connect all of us. WPR's Avery Lee Rogers is obsessed with how these waves turn into sound. When they visited a specialized microphone maker in Janesville, Rogers found out these high-tech microphones connect Wisconsin to the world.
As I drove to Clover Products in Janesville, I expected to arrive at a commercial factory-like setting. But my GPS led me to a one-story, single-family home surrounded by evergreens. As I step inside, I see a grandfather clock, an upright piano, and a couch behind these two acrylic bowl-shaped contraptions on tripods that were over 6 feet tall.
So you build parabolic microphones that are used all across the world in the basement of your house.
In the dining room.
That's Paul Terpstra, mechanical engineer, founder, and co-owner of Clover Products, which makes parabolic microphones. Those can pick up specific sounds from really far away. In his brightly lit basement, he shows me around his Clover Products office, which is decked out in machines, computers, and prototypes. The microphones Terpstra makes are widely used in professional sports like football. The mics have been used in 6 Super Bowls.
A good example is whenever you kick the ball. If you hear that foot hit the ball,
52 yards out, it is booted.
That is captured through a parabolic.
Right down the middle, man. That was good from a million yards out.
I call Lambeau Field my R&D lab.
With the way his business works, Terpstra doesn't always know where his microphones will end up.
The most exciting thing for me was when I saw that they were used at the World Cup. The first time we went to the Olympics.
So your mics have also been to the Olympics?
Oh, yes. Every one since Rio, I think.
Terpstra and his wife, Diane Terpstra, started an engineering company 20 years ago. That company turned into Clover Products almost by accident. In 2011, one of their customers was approached by Fox Sports, looking for a vendor for parabolic microphones.
He comes to me and says, "What do you know about parabolic microphones?" And I said, "Absolutely nothing, but I'll figure it out."
Terpstra developed a prototype and sent it to Fox, where it was tested by their audio engineers.
Fox came back and said, "We want 50 for next year." So it was like, oh, crap.
What does a parabolic microphone look like?
A big Tupperware bowl. If you want to think about a parabolic microphone and how it works, if you think of when you're outside and you cup your hand around your ear, you are in essence creating a sort of quasi-parabolic microphone because you're capturing the sound energy from a larger area and forcing it into your ear.
Terpstra lugged the two giant parabolic microphone setups from his living room out into the front yard. I use them to record birds way up in the trees.
I would say that's about 150 feet. I can see him now. He's in the top of that evergreen. I'm about 75 feet. I'm assuming you can hear me pretty well. And I'm about halfway to the, looks like a house finch.
I actually grew up in the middle of Iowa, and we moved to Janesville in 1985, so we've been here quite a while. It's definitely home for us now.
Terpstra reminds me multiple times.
I'm not an audio engineer by any means, but...
But Clover has produced research about parabolic microphones that hasn't been done before. And that beeping and whirring that's been in the background? Those are the sounds of Terpstra's 3D printers working hard on a secret new experiment that he hopes will take parabolic microphones even further.
That's what the...
WPR's Avery Lee Rogers brought us that story on Janesville's Clover Products. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today. Mushroom foraging has long been a hobby here in Wisconsin, and recently the state started regulating who can sell wild mushrooms to restaurants. Local foragers can now become certified identifiers by taking a mushroom identification course taught through the Wisconsin Mycological Society and others. We'll talk about that course and the new requirements in just a moment with the mushroom expert. But first, we wanted to get a feel for what it's like to hunt and identify mushrooms out in the field. So my co-host Rob Ferret and producer Mackenzie Crummy headed into the woods. They traveled with two mycologists to an undisclosed location in southern Wisconsin.
Yeah, so my name is Jeremy Holmstadt. I'm a elected board member of the Wisconsin Mycological Society.
I'm Brennan Sternad. So only about 2 years ago, I got involved with the Wisconsin Mycological Society, but I hit it real hard. I feel like I'm learning a lot every single day.
It's about 80 degrees. I've got my official mushroom cutting knife, one I grabbed from the kitchen counter, some sunscreen, some bug spray. I am set to go, but I'm a little skeptical at this point. I've gone out mushroom hunting with buddies before and found zero of the mushrooms we were looking for, hoping we do better today.
All right, let's head that way. Especially this time of year, you want to look for mature oak. That's where you're going to find a multitude of your edibles. You'll obviously find mushrooms on there, a lot of different species, but let's kind of head towards that area over there. Right now, we're kind of walking through a mowed area, and here we go.
So we're just 20 feet out of the parking lot, and we've already hit pay dirt. What do we have here?
Yeah, so this is called Chicken of the Woods. It's considered one of the fine, safe edibles you'll find in Wisconsin. It has just a bright orangey color, and depending upon the species, it might have either like a white pore surface or a yellow pore surface.
As we walk around this public park, the just abundance of mushrooms in this area is obvious. There are about 14,000 different species of mushroom. That's according to the National Park Service. Feels like we've encountered most of them just on this trip.
Pheasant back, like the native bird.
This is a huge group of mushrooms called the russula.
And they're called puffballs because if you smack them, little spores come out of them.
There aren't a lot of good psychedelics around Wisconsin, which, for better or worse, this is called Dinopolis.
And so we found that mushroom there. There's a mushroom over there. Here's another one, different species.
Is that tricholoma?
Oh, it's a tricholoma.
It's called a milky cap. So if you damage the gills or any part of the surface, you see this.
When you're identifying mushrooms, you're looking for a lot of things. You're smelling them, touching the cap. How does it feel? Does it have gills? What's the texture? What are the colors? One thing you're not doing is tasting them. And if you do, you spit it out.
Oh, these are
You don't want to eat these.
Well, and for the most part, we want to cook these. If we do find edible ones, we'll want to cook them.
Yes, any edible ones you want to definitely cook.
So if we're going to eat them here, it'll be Mac, not me.
Okay.
Great.
And that is because mushrooms can be poisonous, even deadly. The National Poison Data System reports more than 6,500 cases of people being exposed to toxic mushrooms in 2022. Here's Brennan talking about a specific mushroom we're seeing in the wild called an Amanita.
This is a mushroom that people have died from, especially here. Mm-hmm. So folks that have come from Southeast Asia, especially folks from the Hmong community, when they first came over, ate a lot of this mushroom and died from it. There's a mushroom over there that is not the same, but it looks extremely similar. So they came here and they thought, well, that's the mushroom we're familiar with, and people often die from making that mistake.
That's why these two, Jeremy and Brennan, amateur experts in identifying mushrooms, are so important. They could answer almost any question I threw at them, including this one.
All right, well, let's get into a sensitive topic for radio, reproduction. Are these sexual reproducers, the fungus, or do they clone themselves? How do they work?
They reproduce in any way that they can is the answer. Yeah. Mushroom sex is a very mysterious thing. They'll do it any way they can. Spores sometimes are sexual spores. Sometimes they can reproduce asexually so that one spore can reproduce the whole new organism. But it can get real weird. Morels do it very strange.
And my takeaway from this experience is mushrooms are cool, nature is weird, and even if I get to know mushroom varieties better, I'm never going to eat mushrooms that I forage myself. I'll leave it to the experts to make the safe call. One last note. Brennan and Jeremy asked us to keep their mushroom hunting location undisclosed. They hope to preserve the area where sometimes rare and sensitive species live.
Actually, you know, as foragers and people who explore the woods, we have to be mindful because we're intruding upon their space. And so we have to make sure we clean our shoes of seeds from invasive plants, or try not to overcollect, or try not to trod through very delicate lichens and mosses, because we're just guests here.
Now we turn to Tavis Lynch, the vice president of the Wisconsin Mycological Society. He's been identifying and cultivating mushrooms for more than 35 years, and he recently talked with Rob Ferret.
All right, before we talk about mushrooms, I want to talk about mushroom people. Being out there with Brennan and Jeremy, hearing how they talked about this this community of mycologists, of people into mushrooms. Can you talk a little bit about how people build community around their shared love of all these different kinds of fungus?
Well, it's really quite interesting. You're stuck with a group of people that have a similar interest. You spend a week in the woods with them, and you don't have a choice but to become friends. And our mushroom community is very tight. I think there's about 1,000 to 1,500 of us now around the state that get together just about 30 times throughout the course of the year, and we've developed some very strong bonds between us.
Now, you've been identifying and cultivating mushrooms, I understand, for more than 35 years. What got you into mushrooms in the first place?
It started with looking for morels and meadow mushrooms with my father. And then it got to a point where he couldn't answer my questions anymore, and he said, just go buy a book. So that's what I did, and I've been fascinated with mushrooms since day one, and it's all I do for a living. I chase mushrooms around Wisconsin.
And you've gone beyond just chasing them. You cultivate some now. What brought you from seeking them in the wild to saying, hey, I'm going to grow some of my own?
Actually, what brought me to that was drought. I was struggling to find enough wild mushrooms to supply my restaurants about 20 years ago, and I saw that as my only solution was to control my environment and cultivate my own mushrooms.
Now, we've got this news at the state level, this identification course for foragers selling to food establishments in Wisconsin. What's changing here? What do these requirements mean?
Well, we never really had anything in place before. And the main objective is obviously public safety. We don't want just anyone selling mushrooms to restaurants and grocery stores. And the hobby is growing very, very quickly. So we have a lot of maybe inexperienced, I'll say, people trying to sell mushrooms to the public. And that needs to be regulated for safety purposes. We don't want poisonous mushrooms or misidentified mushrooms being sold in restaurants and grocery stores around the state.
Yeah, if I heard that you were supplying mushrooms to restaurants, I'd feel really good about that, Tavis. If I heard Rob Ferret was supplying mushrooms to restaurants, I'd feel really bad about that. What would somebody, maybe someone a little more advanced than me, somebody who's got some experience foraging, what kind of steps would they go through? What would they go to do this kind of registration and go through this program?
So you would register through the Wisconsin Mycological Society's website. And we did, I think, 6 programs this spring around the state, maybe 7. We did La Crosse, Green Bay, Madison, Milwaukee area, and the Eau Claire area, just to try to, you know, cover the state as best we can. And then you have to listen to me talk for about 6 hours. And then it's a test that takes, that varies. Everyone tests differently. And it usually takes between 45 minutes and 90 minutes to complete the test. But we've had absolute beginners come through and pass the test. And if they can prove their skills and knowledge of mushroom food safety, then they can be trusted to sell mushrooms to restaurants and grocery stores. We also encourage that the health inspectors take the same course and restaurant owners. I think that's good knowledge for them to have as well.
Do you hope that having this in place is going to help people appreciate our variety of edible mushrooms here in the state?
I do. I think we're going to start to see a lot more mushrooms in restaurants on our menus, maybe even perhaps in our grocery stores, farmers markets, and local co-ops. And I think that'll give people a better taste of Wisconsin. Wisconsin has, I would estimate, around 300 good edible mushrooms, all of them being a little bit different from each other. Try them all.
How important is it to make this Wisconsin specific? Because as I understand it, our mushroom ecology, our mushroom varieties are going to be very different from one place to another.
Absolutely. And Wisconsin's very unique in its 4 distinct forest types coming together. Our fungal life here is very distinct. Our mushroom life is different from Michigan. It's different from Minnesota. And it's actually drastically different from Illinois. So it's very important that we concentrate just on our state borders for these mushrooms that we're certifying people for.
And Tavis, before I let you go, you're cultivating, you're foraging. What is on your home menu these days when it comes to mushrooms?
I don't eat mushrooms as often as people think I do, though I did pick some fresh shiitakes this morning, and the hen of the woods is very prolific this year, so I picked a couple of those as well.
Tavis, that sounds great. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That is Tavis Lynch, Vice President of the Wisconsin Mycological Society, and he talked with Rob Ferret about mushroom foraging. Special thanks to Jeremy Holmstadt and Brennan Sternid for showing Rob around the forest, and to producer Mackenzie Crummy and Technical Director Sarah Hopeful for their work on the segment. Yesterday, we heard from the Wisconsin Historical Society about collecting political memorabilia that reflects our state's political history. And then we asked about items you collect. Jay sent along photos of George McGovern buttons from his 1972 presidential bid, along with this reflection. I'm a child of the 60s. We learned to canvass as kids, running door to door and listening to political fundraisers. Clearly, I love the buttons that came with the task. Jay goes on to say, I heard McGovern speak on the Capitol steps. I skipped class to hear then Congressman Mo Udall do the same. And I grew up learning how to be politically active and to wear your buttons proud. Jay, thanks for sharing. And you can get in touch with us. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Or you can call or text us at 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.